Well, hello everyone. I am back once again with Dare Shatten Macca. Today we're going to be talking about managerialism and its future. We live under a kind of soft managerial regime, a soft anarcho-tyranny, as per our previous conversation. Before we get going, where can people find you?
They can find me primarily on YouTube. As you said, Der Schattenmacher, Shadow Maker in the direct translation. You can find this with a normal channel search. And then below every video, there is an email and I think also a Twitter contact, a Twitter handle, where people can send me direct messages if they feel inclined to.
Great. Don't send me a direct message, though. You know, I discovered that there's this thing that you can send requests on Twitter. And I didn't even know this tab existed. I have got something like 4,000 contact requests on Twitter going back 5 years. I just didn't even know the tab was there. So if you've ever tried to reach me on Twitter, just through like sending me a speculative DM, that's not the way. And it's going to be stuck behind some thing that I've never opened. But anyway, pick up a course at the academic agency. Trivia and the Bestseller, buy it now. A bit later on, I'm going to play a little video from Eric Kaufman about his course that is available at the University of Buckingham as well. So, managerialism, does it have a future, Shatten Macca?
That's a good question. First, does it have a past? I mean, I think people don't understand the past correctly. Why did managerialism come into power is the first question that I think we should answer. And that didn't happen for no reason. It happened because the societies of the 19th century, the privately ordered societies or the classical democratic societies, could not handle the masses, could not handle mass problems. So the masses had to be educated to fit into a technological society. The masses had to be insured and retired properly because they were growing older and they were becoming much more of them. And all of these problems could not be handled by, let's say, aristocratic societies. So the big administrators showed up, the mass organizations like the retirement and pension investment funds and all of that. So, and this is a situation where we still live in. I mean, we cannot pretend that we could just at will leave managerialism because we still have a mass of people, we still have a mass producing society, and all of these things have to be administered. But in the past, for example, there were hard managerial regimes like National Socialist Germany per Burnham and like the Soviet Union. So they also had a lot of administrators, also a lot of number types that were doing the work, but they were not shy of using real violence. Not just the soft, demoralizing measures that we see today, but boots on the ground. And as we teased in the previous talk, maybe it becomes necessary one day, even in our regimes, to reuse these methods to gain control over the situation because there have to be too many residues. And then I asked myself the questions, can this transition happen without the destruction of the current elite class? Because, and now we get into another topic, I think what we have is a perfectly class one elite society. So class one and class two, this is a concept by Machiavelli and Pareto and many other sociologists. Class one, these are more administrative types, soft administrative types, people who are good at managing an empire, at doing art stuff or media stuff. And class two, these are more the military oriented types, more conservative, more good with police work, all of that. I mean, everybody gets an impression of what I mean, I think. Sparta and Athens, if you want to have a clear picture. So Sparta being class two then. And the question is,
the lions is the, you know,
right, foxes and lions, right. And as Francis says, I mean, of obviously sometimes we have mixed regimes. So Caesar, for example, would be a mixed person. He was good at everything. And also the what came after Caesar, Augustus, and his general, I can't remember the name now, but he had a great general, and they were friends together. They did not try to kick each other from the positions of power, cooperated, and they could consolidate the empire. So a mixed regime is often the best. The problem is, Agrippa was the name. The problem is that the class one and class two elites usually hate each other. They see in each other a threat and also the epitome of incompetence because they are exactly good at the things that each of the group devalues. So we have class one society because the class one devalues the talents of class two. And as a consequence of that, our system is degenerating along the blind spots of a class one society. So we cannot handle security issues, maybe with the long-term prowess that they should be handled. Then the question is, how if this becomes a situation that is too uncontrolled or too uncontrollable, would have a class two revolution need to happen in order to bring back order to society? And would this class two revolution not clean up the current elite? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the person watching, we should try to make it concrete. I think the most concrete example I can think of in this country is the so-called small boat crisis. Okay, mm-hmm. you're aware of this, okay? We have hundreds, thousands of illegal immigrants turning up on the south coast, in Dover, right? Coming from France, coming from Calais, every single day. And they turn up on these little small boats, smuggled in, essentially, through a clandestine criminal network. And the class one, the foxes, struggle with this problem. They're constrained by all sorts of rules, European, convention on human rights, this law, that law, or what we allow to do, you know, whereas the lion or the class two would simply just be like, oh, this is a shore. We have gunboats. This is Britain. We have literally the oldest naval tradition in the world. We conquered the world through gunboats, the Spanish Armada, etc. Clearly, you just get a massive gun and you blast every single boat off the coast, right? This is the, I'm cartoon. It's not that even that cartoonish. This is the distinction between the class one solution and the class two solution. So the question is, given that this foxy class one, they call it a persuasion, right? Managerialism of persuasion.
Yes.
Versus force. That's in the literature, they call it masters of persuasion versus masters of using force. How can it actually happen? And I actually have a book here that was put out in the 1950s looking at how it happened in the Soviet Union when Stalin took over from Lenin.
Yes.
And what happened to these intellectuals? You know, there was like Bukharin and Trotsky and all these other people who had to be purged, literally exiled, purged, murdered, Moscow trials. And then who Stalin put in each of those positions. And effectively what he did was he genuinely elevated some peasantry, right? So not people who were writing books and things, people who were masters of using force, people who were prepared to say, look, we've got a problem here. These 10,000 people here, if we don't do something about it, they're gonna cause an issue. No compunction whatsoever about using those methods. One of the challenges I see, though, is that, how can I say? Well, there's two challenges. Mm. The first challenge is we're so used to living in the regime of soft persuasion, in the soft managerialism, that almost everybody's thinking is of the system one type. And this is quite thoroughgoing. If you actually read Pareto properly, he's not simply talking about, cunning bureaucrats. He's talking about entrepreneurs. He's talking about money men. He's talking about, he's got a whole chapter about the distinction between an entrepreneur who wants to take risks, who's happy with change and, who wants to innovate. This is a class one type versus the saver. And he says that the saver is an identifiable type in society. The little old woman who keeps her money under the bed, or, it's a much more conservatively minded. And these two groups are actually at odds on an economic level, as well as in terms of their disposition or their sentiments, as Pareto puts it. Trouble is that in order for the lion truly to take over, he has to take on those entrenched moneyed interests, the entrepreneurs, and the way everybody thinks now is, well, the way to do anything in our society is that you need like billionaires on side, or, well, we don't want to upset the banks and things like this. This is what we're seeing with Trump. The Lotus Eaters literally did a whole roundtable where they argued about the nature of foxes and lions. Dan from the Lotus Eaters said, well, look, Trump is a lion, okay? And you're thinking like a fox, AA. Trump is a lion. And I was like, no, Trump is a fake. He's not a real lion.
Yes, I think that's true, yeah. He's not a real lion.
But this is the issue, I guess, because when I gave the examples of lions in history, which was, literally Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, to some extent Napoleon, Hitler, Stalin, all these sorts of figures, actual lions. And then if you want to come into after that, Idi Amin, Saddam Hussein, people's minds were like, oh, you're being too extreme there. That's too extreme. And I'm like, well, no. If you're actually serious about this, you have to be prepared to ruthlessly use force against your rivals. And basically what you're telling me when you say that stuff is extreme is you don't have the stomach for it. So actually all this talk of, Trump is a lion and so on, he's not going to have the stomach to take on the banks. He's not going to have the stomach to, have a look at this situation with the ICE officers and stuff to see that through. He didn't do that. What he did was he had a meeting with Mike Waltz, to de-escalate it.
Yeah. I mean, I see the problem too. I mean, I tried to give him my little booklet advice to politicians in Germany that they could still follow. If I advise them to be like Hitler, they won't, for obvious reasons. But I tried to come up with a person from, let's say, the democratic age. And I found it partly in Andrew Jackson, for example. It was the sixth or seventh president of the United States. He was a general of the Indian Wars, and he was generally, obviously, from his character disposition, a lion. I think he had several hundred duels in his life, and he was fond of killing people. So, and he did basically, he made true the promises of Trump. He did take on the banks. He did ignore or try to ignore the rulings of the Supreme Court. He did fill the own ranks with loyalists. So obviously we can ask now, was this enough? Because after Jackson came, still the 20th century, we can ask all of these questions, but as an orientation point of orientation for our politicians who can't orient themselves publicly, especially on Hitler and Stalin, I think Andrew Jackson would be a more reasonable example. And even going into this direction, I mean, would be the first step, I think. I mean, at least this has to happen first before we can take a reasonable action.
One of the things that people don't really discuss that much, I mean, we've kind of migrated over to foxes and lions here.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth pursuing with this line of thought.
Yeah.
If you read Pareto properly, the lion is always a short-run phenomenon. That is, things have got to such a point, they've degenerated under the foxes. The foxes have weakened things sufficiently that now only lion methods are going to be able to sort things out and restore order. Okay.
Yes.
But then Pareto says, because the class twos lack any sort of real idea and don't have a flair for administration and so on, what tends to happen is that after the lion, things then slip back into being the fox. The circulation comes relatively quickly after the lion kind of shakes things up a bit. If you think of all of those people I mentioned, they generally were short run. Even in the case of Stalin, after he died, what happened is that the bureaucracy took back over, and by the time you get to Brezhnev and that whole, the tripartite triumvirate, whatever they were called, in the 1970s, basically the Russian deep state had taken back over, and they were back to being foxes.
Yeah, even Khrushchev was not a lion anymore. Yeah, sure. I have no illusion about that. I mean, if I'm blackpilled about one thing is living in a political utopia for good. This will never happen. All political systems will degenerate, and they will degenerate most often along their blind spots. And as you said, the blind spot of the class two individual is administration in peacetime. That is unfortunately true. But on the other hand, yeah, the blind spot of the class one is degeneration in peacetime due to the lack of control about the hard aspects of life. So I think this will be a circle of change for the decades and centuries to come, and we can do nothing about this. Nonetheless, we have, I mean, in between, there are sometimes mixed regimes and there are sometimes good times, and this is basically the most we can aim for. I mean, of course, this is demoralizing because people want to live in utopia. They want to have these great aims of a great society. I have difficulties believing in this too, but we can still improve. I mean, there were, for example, the United States in the 19th century were clearly a more effective and a better regime for their people than they have now. So we can aim from the 19th century or some equivalent that we could realize in the 21st. So that is my goal first. So I'm not I'm not striving for utopia here. And second, I think we see the degenerating effects of the class one rule in more than just a lack of control on the streets. With hard means. For example, Francis speaks about the dematerialization of property. The entrepreneur that you mentioned, I think he is, even he is a dying breed, because in our world, we don't have so many companies that are founded anew. Yeah, in the digital industry, we have some, but in the classical industries, we basically have none. All of these big companies are now managerial companies, and they have a lot of problems too. I mean, sure, they can make things on scale, and they are very efficient in certain types of action, but they lack, for example, innovation. I mean, Francis gives a good example. In precognition of the digital revolution, he says, we had IBM, we have had AT&T, we had big electronics companies, but still the internet was revolutionized and basically made up, or cooked up by startups. How can this be? How can such a big managerial colossus not dominate the internet immediately? And he says, yeah, that is a consequence of the class one entrenched managerial structure. They are not as good as small companies, for example, in forming innovations and coming up with new ideas in new ways. Maybe this sounds for some people like grasping for straws, but I think we have to start somewhere, and looking precisely at the weak spots of our enemies and of the current regimes is important. I think this is one of them.
How do you, I mean, speaking of entrepreneurs, how do you analyze and make sense of the based billionaire class that has emerged? You know, Elon Musk is the most visible, but there's also Peter Thiel and various others. Yeah. As an identifiable emergent class, they are obviously of interest from a power perspective. But there's something about those guys that has also always struck me, that they're not quite the same as the old tycoons. You know, like the you know, the J.P. Morgans or Henry Ford or people like this.
Rockefellers, yeah.
Or Rockefeller. They're different because they made their money mainly through government contracts. And you know, I've heard Elon Musk described before as like basically a vaporware salesman or a seller of dreams or something.
Sure.
And his wealth is actually built on share price, you know, market cap and things like this.
But yeah, anyway, illusions, basically, yeah. The tremendous amount of money that he has, or the equivalent in stock, this is based on media illusions. Sure. So Francis, I think, has a very good theory about this. Again, I think really worth reading him. So he says, in the beginning, when managerialism formed in the late 19th and early 20th century, there were still a lot of friction between the classical entrepreneur types like Andrew Carnegie or all the people you mentioned and the managers. Of course, they needed each other, especially the entrepreneurs needed the managers to expand their companies, but the way of handling things was different. This is like the difference between, let's say, Adolf Hitler and Adolf Eichmann, for example. Eichmann was the head of the Jewish deportation organization. So, but they were different types. Hitler was an outgoing person who gave speeches, who had interpersonal talents, and Eichmann and Heydrich, for example, were managers, so administrators. And there's not the same skill class. And the same friction we saw on the field of economics in America between classical entrepreneurs and managers. So they the entrepreneurs like to handle the things personally with personal relation, and the managers look at numbers. So this has each its advantage and its disadvantage. And I think in most classical fields of industry, we don't see new entrepreneurs because we lack innovation, and there are other reasons for it. But on the digital realm, we still had some entrepreneurs, original startups with people like Andrew Carnegie founding their companies. And I think we see a reflection of the same strain of managerialism, of over-regularization between these entrepreneurs and the modern managerial class. It is not as severe as it was in the early 20th century due to the area of expertise or the field that these new entrepreneurs founded their companies in, because this was the digital realm, and digital companies are prone to be occupied by class one manager types because they mainly deal in media manipulation and information gathering and all the things that make class one people good. And so this counter-revolution from an entrepreneurial force could never develop the same persistence as in the early 20th century. Though in the early 20th century, for Francis' theory, it was these entrepreneur types, these classical bourgeois types that hold up the manager revolution for quite some decades. And I think this is the difference.
What I'm trying to get at, though, I mean, we can't know for sure. Why are these guys funding and backing publicly the quote-unquote based revolution? Why has Peter Thiel got behind Curtis Yarvin? Why, when Tommy Robinson holds a rally in London, does Elon Musk get up onto a massive cinema screen and tell the crowd, look, you're going to have to get out there and fight on the streets and things like that? What are they up to? What are they doing?
Well, sure, they are. I can't be sure. There could be the great conspiracy in the background. If it is so, then I don't know. But I could imagine that these people have a rough outline of the world that is similar to what I described now, and they try to return to some state of the 19th and early 20th century, maybe with an incomplete understanding, and they try to back everything that looks like it, that looks like it could give them a way back into the, let's say, entrepreneurial dominated society. And Donald Trump was the best they could find, so they invest in him. But of course, this investment has a lot of compromises built within it, and so far, it is not enough to really challenge the system. But in the best case scenario, it's that, I think.
So we wanted to talk about managerialism and its future.
Yes.
One of the things that I've been thinking about, because I've been talking about these sorts of things for many years at this point, is do we discount the possibility of the system just being able to limp on and on? Because I look at situations that are much worse than the ones that our governments face. Let's take Iran, right? That's been in the news recently. The government there, the regime there, is widely disliked by many, many sections of society. It's been seen as a failure. They are prepared to use hard force, but they are also, I would say, the mullahs in Iran are more fox than they are lion. They're generally very cautious, and they use a lot of sneaky perception management tricks and things as well. But it seems like they just limp on, right? I mean, people are facing like severe economic difficulties. Sometimes they're not getting paid, hyperinflation and so on. It's even been run as a narrative in the media, or the people will rise up and all this sort of stuff. Just never happens. And this is what again, I don't want to black pill. I'm just trying to see things as they are. Mm-hmm. I wonder, we're recording this after the Epstein files have come out. As far as I can see, nothing's happened. In America in 2020, more than half the country thought that the election was stolen. Nothing happened. We've just seen like everybody's got this notion that eventually something has got to give. Often nothing happens. Even on a micro level, every other week something happens to the Keir Starmer. He's not going to be able to keep this up forever. He's not going to make it to 2029. This must be the end. Nothing happens. You understand what I mean, right?
Yeah, sure.
It's like,
I obviously can't exclude the possibility that the limping on will go for quite some time. I don't know the future. I will still give another perspective. For example, I'm a natural scientist by normie occupation, and there's something like the Ising model describing phase transitions in physics. So, and you can also apply this to social situations. So sometimes you have phenomena like the freezing of a liquid where you cool down the situation and nothing happens, and then you touch the liquid and it basically instantly gets to ice. And it's very hard to understand this phenomenon on a physical level. So it's very complicated mathematics, but you can simulate it on a simplified scale as the Ising model, as some lattice where the states flip. And these have all of these phase transitions have highly nonlinear characteristics to them. So for a long time, there is basically, even if the underlying parameter changes, no change in the phenotype of the system, so to say. But then all of a sudden, it changes its outward phase. And the question is, can we observe something similar in the world of social actions in the world of politics? I think we can. I think revolutions have exactly this type. Of course, it would be a bit simple to just defer the people to some coming revolution again and again. But then coming back to a realistic scenario where this could start or could happen, I mean, in Germany, due to the mismanagement of this country, not just in questions of the migrant crisis, but also in questions of the energy resources of this country, we have not only seen a rise in AfD support, we have also seen a rise in bankruptcy among our economic sector, firms in our economic sector. And I mean, it is obvious that we cannot sustain a five times increased insolvency rate year after year after year for the next 100 years without seeing some change. So I think all you're describing could be true, but it is also could be just the consequences of having a very thick layer of armor basically built up by the relatively prosperous second half of the 20th century that first has to be reduced until we get to the bone, to the lower strata of Maslow's pyramid for people, and then have a chance for fundamental political change.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I've been thinking about recently, especially since Mark Carney, I don't know if you happened to catch the speech by Mark Carney at Davos, is how can I put this? Let's say this Trump cycle plays out in America now in such a way that it ends up discrediting the right more broadly, discrediting the populist right. And in the short run, while they're being discredited, somehow the neoliberal center, right? And now this sounds ridiculous because we're literally talking about Starmer in this country, Mertz in Germany, although it doesn't have to be these specific characters. Mm-hmm. It's just the system, what we call the regime, right? The center regime. Yeah. Says, look, and this is the thrust of Carney's speech. I mean, Carney literally came out and said, look, we've been putting up with lies for the past 8 years. These were polite fictions that we told ourselves, well, we have to get real now, blah, blah, blah. And they say, well, look, we understand that there's an issue here. The mass immigration has not worked out. That the green shit is a problem, okay? And it hasn't worked out. And also, incidentally, China has created more pollution than the entire Industrial Revolution put together just last year, okay? And things like this. Tony Blair's already started to talk like this. And they say, look, we've heard you. We're going to sort these out. We are actually serious. This lot of populist guys, they're just clowns, basically. They're foreign-backed agitators who are trying to disrupt our system. Trust us. These guys are just leading up the garden path. We're the real deal because we're the actual government. We are the actual power structure. We're gonna turn this ship around. We're gonna be serious for a while. This move, which sounds far-fetched, because people always say, well, you know, the regime is ideological, the regime is too far gone, et cetera, et cetera. I'm watching them doing it. they've started. I mean, Starpin in this country started to do it. Carney has started to do it in Canada as well. Germany still, for some reason, has not got the memo.
You're right.
I don't see it, right? But it could get the memo, is my point, right?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. Could it? I mean, everybody expected Merz, the leader of the classical conservative party, to behave in exactly the way you're describing, that he does some half-tough deal, that he contains the situation somehow. But he couldn't even do this. I mean, he didn't even do 10%. He gave basically the Social Democrats everything they wanted to have. He did not close the borders in any way. He did not get rid of even the most criminal or useless migrants. He did not even improve the politically uncontroversial economic situation. Yeah, we could import gas from Russia, for example, but even that is not allowed due to the Russo-Ukrainian conflict, which is ridiculous because even in the Cold War, where we were that fast ideological enemies, we imported gas from Russia. But not even that is possible anymore. So I'm not sure if this change will come soon, and if it comes, it will be severe enough. But I want to give also another perspective. You are always concentrating, I think, or black-pilling, because you are concentrating too much on the highest strata of power. Of course, there very often doesn't happen anything. Or if it happens, it's happening, it's a controlled opposition. But when I drive around Germany and give my my speeches, what I often learn is that even the people that are willing to induce change and that are working at the basis of the AfD, they don't have the proper information and mindset and worldview to conduct this change. And that's not due to their resistance of will, but due to the lack of knowledge. So the things that we are discussing here, the managerial revolution and Pareto and all of these things, they have to get into the masses, at least into the party masses, into the entire strata of the political counter elite, and we are still not there. So if I would agree with you, if every member of the AfD would be on our information level regarding the type of our regime, and we still cannot induce any change, then I think it's the proper time to black pill. But so far, every time I give a talk, I still encounter people who have a completely naive view of politics, and as long as this is the case, I think we cannot hope for proper change, but we also should not give up trying to induce this change by education.
All right, well, we will see. Best of luck.
I mean, I think isn't this the reason why you go on with what you do? Because I mean, otherwise you could just give up and do nothing. But I think you still have to contain some hope within you to continue.
Yeah, obviously I have some hope, but increasingly I look at, you know, because people do this with elections all the time, like the second, like the least worst evil type thing.
Yeah,
and I mean, when I look at the landscape here, I mean, the genuine question that the public are being asked are, do you want to take the old Conservative Party led with a clown nose stuck on the front of it and Nigel Farage in front of it and Reform UK as a kind of, you know, do you want to put all your hopes and dreams in this? They're going to let you down. Everybody knows this. Or, you know, given that revolution is impossible, given that even the red-pilled normie does not really want to take the true, like, does not really want to go all the way. And I've seen that increasingly people, like, kind of love copium, I guess. They just love, they just imbibe on it. So given that reality, you're never going to have the revolution, at least not in the short run. Is the best we can hope for this like the competent containment where the regime just like does some of the stuff we want. The example I point to is this, you know, the negative net migration in Canada was achieved by Mark Carney without any right wing on the map at all. there was no populism there, and they didn't even make a song and dance about it. They just kind of did it with ruthless efficiency under the hood. Because this is the other thing I worry about, which is that, how can I put it? does the fact that there's a populist party on the board, right? So let's say Nigel Farage in this country, the fact he exists, the fact that he's there, activates and gives like a kind of meaning to the leftist. The leftist is ready for a fight on immigration now with Nigel Farage. Whereas if he wasn't there, let's just pretend we lived in the Tony Blair Reich here, okay? Yeah. And there was no populism on the map at all. They could do it and not even have a headline about it. They could sort out the crisis and it wouldn't even be a headline. Right? And this is kind of counterintuitive, but this is the thing I wonder about, is that does populism actually take us further away from sorting out the problem? It's a genuine question. I don't know.
I mean, you're asking the same question that you would ask at the poker table. I mean, you have your cards and you can play them a certain way, but then you could ask yourself, okay, but if I put no money in a pot and he has better cards than me, then I just make the situation worse for me. Yet, that is true. But still, there are statistical underlying rules by which you should follow. And even if you lose in the particular situation, it was still a good move to do this because it was a statistically projected right thing to do. Now, it's very hard to recognize what the statistically correct thing to do is in our world. I admit that. And I also see that sometimes, of course, I have here the weaker position because I want to make change by spreading information and you argue basically against that through material means. The opposition has, or the regime has, much more material means. And this is all true. What I think we have still no options because we cannot do other things. We still have to first distribute the information, and then we have to hope that the material means of the regime are not endless and that they get diminished by the wrong decisions that they take. I mean, if this is not the case, and it could be not the case, then we can do nothing. But this is the game of poker, right? I mean, we could, the opponent could just have quads and we're beaten every time, or royal flush. But we should not play like this, because if we play like this, we lose under guarantee.
Well, there's a lot more I want to discuss with you, but we have a third video where we're going to get into more of this sort of stuff. Like, one of the things I wonder about is, you know, in this country, people are always like, well, look, for all the band of Farage or Trump or whatever, They're a stepping stone. I made a whole video comparing Farage to what's his name, Alfred Hugenberg, precursor, you know, to the mustache man in Germany.
Yeah, the media mogul who helped Hitlerize. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the whole purpose of that was not to say that this analogy is correct. It was to show the absurdity of it, to show just how radical Hugenberg was compared to what Farage is, right? And this, how this argument of the stepping stone is not quite right. But anyway, we can get into all of that soon. Before we get there, Shakamaka, where can people find you, sir?
They can find me on YouTube. That's the most easy way. I mean, I have a Twitter handle @Lichtstifter, but this is also linked below every of my YouTube videos, so it's the easiest way. Go to YouTube, type in Der Schattenmacher, I think also linked under your video here, and then you can contact me via Twitter or via email if you have a detailed question.
Before we wrap up here, I'll just remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, and you can also now head to the University of Buckingham and pick up this course from Eric Kaufman. If I can play it.
The ideology of our universities and many other institutions can accurately be described as woke. Woke is not an epithet, but used properly describes the dominant cultural left belief system of Western institutions. Have you ever wondered how woke came about, who believes in it, and why? Or how the culture war between woke and anti-woke forces is redefining society and politics? Well, there's good news. I've developed a 15-week online course on woke at the University of Buckingham, which is open to the global public, the first of its kind in the world. The course is not assessed, but is focused instead on deepening your understanding of woke. I offer a rigorous objective analysis of this phenomenon, similar to the way I would for fascism, communism, or any other ideology. I've studied the cultural left since the mid-1990s, and I'm ideally placed to help you understand woke. Sign up today using the attached link.
So there it is. Join us next time, guys.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.